One year ago. "You think you can just pop in here whenever you want?" I said. I was joking, but I was surprised that Owen snuck up on me, showing up at my workshop unannounced in the middle of the workday. He didn't usually do that. He spent his days at the offices in Palo Alto, sometimes heading to downtown San Francisco for a meeting. He was rarely home on a weekday, except when Bailey needed him for something. "If I popped in whenever I wanted, I'd be here constantly," he said. "What are we making?" He rubbed his hands together, happy to be in the studio with me. He loved my work, loved being a part of it. And every time I saw how genuinely he felt that way, it was another small reminder how lucky I was to love him. "What are you doing home so early?" I asked. "Is everything okay?" "That depends," he said. He lifted my face shield to give me a kiss hello. I was in my work clothes, which consisted of a high-necked jacket and that face shield, a combination that made me look like I belonged in the future and the past at the same time. "Is my chair finished?" I kissed him back, draping my arms around his shoulders. "Not quite yet," I said. "And it's not your chair." It was a Windsor chair I was making for a client in Santa Barbara for her interior design office, but as soon as Owen had seen it in progress, the dark, chiseled elm, a heightened hoop back, he decided we couldn't let it go. He decided it was meant for him. "We'll see about that," he said. This was when his phone buzzed. Owen looked down at the caller ID, his face darkening. He clicked decline. "Who was that?" I said. "Abbott," he said. "I'll call him later." He clearly didn't want to talk about it, but I couldn't leave it there, not when I felt the heat coming off him. Not when he was getting this worked up just from a call he didn't take. "What's going on with him?" "He's being a little irrational, that's all."
"About what?"
"The IPO," he said. "It's not a big deal." But it was flashing in his eyes, a mix of anger and irritation, two things he rarely displayed, two things he had displayed more recently. And of course he was standing in my workshop, as opposed to in his own office. I tried to choose my words carefully, wanting to help, but not wanting to undermine him. I didn't have to work in an office, didn't have to deal with the politics of having a boss I had to answer to. Someone like Abbott Thompson, with whom I might not agree. And yet I wanted to figure out how to say it, that I saw Owen's stress level rising, that it was just a job, that as far as I was concerned, he could always find another. Before I said anything, the phone buzzed again, Abbott showing up on the caller ID. Owen looked down at his phone. He looked down at it, like he was going to pick it up, his fingers hovering there. But he hit decline again, pocketing his phone instead. He shook his head. "It doesn't matter how many times I say the same thing. Abbott doesn't want to hear it," he said. "What we need to make this all work." My grandfather used to say that most people don't want to hear the thing that will make it work better, I said. They want to hear what will make it easier.
And what did he say to do about that?
Find other people. You know, for starters. He tilted his head, took me in.
"How do you always know what to say to me?" he said.
"Well, it's really my grandfather saying it, but sure," I said. He reached for my hand, a smile spreading across his face, like nothing happened, or at least like it wasn't as important as he thought it was.
"Enough about this," he said. "Let's go see my chair."
He started pulling me to the door, toward the backyard and the deck where the chair was drying, sanded, newly polished. "You know you can't have that chair," I said. "Someone commissioned it. She is paying us a lot of money for it."
"Good luck to her," he said. "Possession is 9/10 of the law."
I smiled. "What do you know about the law?"
"Enough to know if I'm sitting in that chair, he said. No one else is going to take it. Delete all history. At 10 a.m., the hotel cafe is already busy, the lights dimmed. I sit at the bar, drinking an orange juice, while most of the people around me are starting in on morning cocktails, mimosas and Bloody Marys, champagne, white Russians. I stare at the row of televisions, all tuned to different news shows. They come at me in closed captions, most of them reporting on the shop. PBS shows footage of Avett Thompson being handcuffed and escorted away. MSNBC has a preview of Bell's Today Show interview, Bell calling Avett's arrest a travesty of justice. CNN's Chiron keeps warning that more indictments are coming, on repeat. It's almost like a promise, mirroring Grady's promise, that Owen will be in even more trouble soon, that whatever he is running from is about to catch him. This is what gnaws at me over and over when I think of my husband. That something is coming for him, for all of us, that he couldn't stop. That he has left me to try and stop it for him. I take out my notepad and go back over what Grady said during our phone call, trying to recall every detail, trying to hone in on what may be important to glean from it. I keep coming back to how he said that Owen might have erased his own online history. And as wrong as that feels, I try to move myself there, to that assumption, to see what it shows me. Which is when I land on it. That there are certain things we can't erase, certain things that we reveal to the people closest to us despite what we may or may not know we are telling them. There are things that, without meaning to, Owen has told only me. So I make another list. A list of everything I know about Owen's past. Not the false facts, Newton, Princeton, Seattle. The other facts, the non-facts, things I learned accidentally during our time together. Things that in retrospect seem like strange encounters. Like the guy from Roosevelt High School. I look Roosevelt up and find 86 of them spread across the United States. None of them are anywhere near Massachusetts. But 8 of them, in places like San Antonio and Dallas, are spread out across Texas. I put a pin in that and keep thinking, landing on the night with Owen at the hotel, the piggy bank on the bar. Which is when I realize something about that piggy bank, something I've been struggling to remember. Am I remembering it correctly now, or am I conjuring up the memory out of something like desperation? I shoot Jules a text to check it out for me and keep thinking. I keep working my way through things only I know, the anecdotes and stories that Owen has told me late at night, just the two of us, the way you only do with the person you've chosen, the witness to your life. Those stories, the stories he shared when he didn't even realize he was sharing, can't all be false, too. I refuse to believe it. I will refuse to believe it until I'm proven wrong. I start rolling through them, Owen's greatest hits. The time he took a boat trip down the eastern seaboard with his father, barely 16 years old, the only time he ever spent several days alone with his father. The time during his senior year of high school that he let his girlfriend's dog out to play and the dog ran away. Owen getting fired from his first job for spending that afternoon searching for the dog instead of returning to work. The time he snuck into the midnight screening of Star Wars with his pals, his parents awake at 2:45 a.m. when he finally walked in. And a story he told me about college. About why he started to love engineering and technology so much. Owen's freshman year of college, barely 19 years old, he took a mathematics course with a professor he adored, someone he credited with his current career. Even though the professor told Owen he was the worst student he'd ever had. Had he told me what the professor's name was? Tobias something? Was it Newton? Or was it Professor Newhouse? And didn't he have a nickname he went by? I race upstairs and back into the hotel room to wake Bailey, the one person who maybe has heard the story about this professor more times than I have. I pull the comforter off and sit down on the edge of her bed. "I'm sleeping," she says. "Not anymore," I say. She reluctantly props herself up against the headboard. "What is it?" "Do you remember the name of your father's professor? The one he loved so much, who taught him freshman year?" "I have no idea what you're talking about," she says. I fight my impatience, thinking of all the times Bailey has rolled her eyes at this story, at how Owen has used it as a teaching opportunity. He's used it to convince Bailey to stick with something that matters to her, to commit to her plan. He's used it when he was trying to convince her of the opposite. "You know this story, Bailey. The professor taught that impossible course in gauge theory and global analysis. Your father loves talking about him, the professor who told him that he was the worst student he'd ever had, and how that actually made Owen want to do better, how it focused him." Bailey starts nodding, a slow recognition. "You mean the guy who put my father's midterm on the bulletin board, right?" she says. "So he wouldn't forget all the ways he could improve?" "Exactly, yes. Sometimes your passion takes work and you shouldn't give up on it just because it isn't easy." She takes on Owen's voice, imitating him. "Sometimes, kid, you need to work harder to get to a better place." "That's it, yes, that's him. I think his first name was Tobias, but I need to know his full name. Please tell me you remember it." "Why?" she says. "Just can you remember it, Bailey?" "He called him by his last name sometimes, a nickname for his last name. But it started with a J, didn't it?" "Maybe, I don't know." "No, I don't think that was it. It was Cook. He called him Cook. So maybe it was Cooker," she says. "Or was it Cookman?" I smile, almost laughing out loud. She's right. I know it as soon as I hear it. It's good to know I wasn't even close. "What's so funny?" she says. "You're freaking me out." "Nothing. That's great. That's what I needed to know," I say. "Go back to sleep." "I don't want to," she says. "Tell me what you figured out." I open my phone and I plug his name into the search engine. How many professors with the name Tobias Cookman could there be who teach college-level mathematics? And more specifically, gauge theory and global analysis? One that I find. One who is teaching theoretical mathematics. One who has dozens of accolades and awards for his teaching. One who, from the set of photographs that pop up, looks just as surly as Owen has described him. Wrinkled brow, a deep frown, and for some reason, in many of the photographs, he is also perpetually clad in red cowboy boots. Professor Tobias Cook Cookman. He has never worked at Princeton University. But for the last 29 years, he has been on the faculty at the University of Texas at Austin. It's science, isn't it? We take a cab this time. Bailey stares down at her hands, not blinking, looking more than a little stunned. I'm spinning, too, working to hold my center. It's one thing when a private investigator intuits that your husband's name is different, that the details of his life are different. But if this pans out, if Owen took this class with this Professor Cookman, it's our first piece of proof, real proof, that Owen lied about the story of his life. It's the first proof that my instinct was right, that his story, Owen's real story, somehow may begin and end in Austin. It feels like a victory that we are moving closer to the truth. But when the truth is taking you somewhere you don't want to go, you also aren't sure. You aren't sure you want that win. The cab pulls up to the College of Natural Sciences,
A collection of buildings that's bigger and more expansive than my entire liberal arts college, campus and dorms included. I turn and look at Bailey. She is taking in the buildings, the relaxed green running through and around them. Even considering the circumstances, it's hard not to be impressed, especially when we get out of the car and start walking through the green and over the small bridge that leads to the Department of Mathematics. The building that is home to UT's mathematics, physics, and astronomy departments. The ego wall proudly showcases that this building graduates hundreds of the most impressive science and math students in America each year. And it's also home to Nobel Prize winners, Wolf Prize winners, Abel Prize winners, Turing Award winners, and Fields Medal winners, including our Fields Medal winner, Professor Cookman. As we take the escalator up to his office, we see a large poster of Professor Cookman's face, same frown, same wrinkled brow. The poster reads, "Texas Scientists Changed the World," and it lists some of Professor Cookman's research, some of his awards, Fields Medal winner, finalist for the Wolf. We arrive in front of his office, and Bailey cues up her phone to a photograph of Owen, the oldest photograph either of us has with us in Texas, in the hope that Professor Cookman is someone who is willing to look at it. The photograph is from a decade ago. Owen is hugging Bailey after her first school play. Bailey is still in costume, and Owen has his arms wrapped proudly around her shoulders. Bailey's face is mostly obscured by the mess of flowers he gave her, Gerbera daisies and carnations and lilies, a bouquet larger than her whole body. Bailey is peeking out from behind the flowers, a big smile on her face. Owen is looking at the camera, happy, laughing. It's almost too much to look at the photograph, especially when I zoom in on Owen. His eyes bright and lively, almost like he's here, almost like he could be here. I try to give Bailey a supportive smile as we walk inside and find a graduate student sitting behind a desk in the outer office. She wears black wire-rim glasses and is focused on grading a thick stack of student papers. She doesn't look up, doesn't put her red pen down, but she clears her throat. "Can I help you?" she says, like it's the last thing she wants to do. "We are hoping to speak with Professor Cookman," I say. "That much is obvious," she says. "Why?" "My father's an old student of his," Bailey says. "He's teaching," she says. "Besides, you need an appointment." "Of course, but what Bailey here is trying to explain to you is that she too is interested in becoming a student at UT, like her father. And Neilan Simonson over in admissions suggested that she sit in on Professor Cookman's class today." She looks up. "Who in admissions?" she asks. "Neilan?" I say, trying hard to sell the name I just made up. "He said if Cook can't convince Bailey to come here, no one can. He thought she should sit in on his class today." She raises her eyebrows. My use of his nickname, Cook, stops her, makes her believe me. "Well, class is half over, but if you want to sit in on the rest of it, I guess I can take you down there." "That would be great," Bailey says. "Thanks." She rolls her eyes, uninterested. "So let's do this," she says. We follow her out of the office and walk down several staircases until we arrive at a large lecture hall. "When you walk in, you'll be at the front of the class," she says. "Don't stop. Don't look at Professor Cookman. Head up the stairs and go directly to the back of the lecture hall. Got it?" I nod. "Sure." "If you disrupt his class in any way, he'll ask you to leave," she says. "Believe me." She opens the door and I start to thank her, but she puts her finger to her mouth, shushing me. What did I just say? Then she is gone, shutting the door behind her, leaving us inside. We stare at the closed door. Then we do what she said. I keep my eyes straight ahead as we walk up the staircase, heading to the back of the lecture hall, passing the 80-something students who fill the seats.
I motion to a spot against the back wall, and we head there, trying to make ourselves invisible. Only then do we turn and face the room. Professor Cookman stands at the front, behind a small podium. In person, he looks to be about 60, and no taller than 5'5", even in those red cowboy boots, which seem to add an extra few inches. Everyone's eyes are on him. Everyone is focused. No one is whispering to his or her neighbor. No one is checking email. No one is sending texts. As Professor Cookman turns to write something on the large blackboard, Bailey leans toward me. "Neilan Simonson," she whispers. "Did you make that up?" "Are we standing here or not?" I say. "We are. So what does it matter?" I think we are being quiet, but we are loud enough that someone in the back row turns and looks at us. What is worse, Professor Cookman stops writing on the blackboard and turns too. He glares at us, the whole class following suit. I feel myself flush and look down. He doesn't say anything, but he doesn't turn away from us either, not for a good minute, a minute that feels like it's lasting far longer than that. Thankfully, eventually, he turns back to the blackboard and continues his lecture. We observe the rest of class silently, and it's easy to see why everyone is so focused on Professor Cookman. Despite his stature, he's an impressive man. He runs the class like a show, captivating his students, and maybe also scaring them. He only calls on students who aren't raising their hands. When they know the answer, Cookman looks away, no acknowledgement. When a student doesn't know the answer, he keeps his eyes on the offender. He stares until it is uncomfortable, a little like he looked at us. Only then does he call on someone else. After he writes a final equation on the board, he announces that the class is over and he dismisses everybody for the day. The class streams out, and we head down the stairs to where he stands by his desk, packing his messenger bag. It seems like he doesn't see us, continuing to pack up his papers, but then he starts speaking.
"Do you make it a habit to interrupt lectures?" he says. "Or should I count myself as special?"
"Professor Cookman," I say, "I'm sorry about that. We didn't mean for you to hear us."
"Do you think that makes it better or worse?" he says. "Who are you exactly? And why are you in my classroom?"
"I'm Hannah Hall, and this is Bailey Michaels," I say. He looks back and forth between us, searching for more.
"Okay.
We're looking for some information about a former student of yours," I say. "We're hoping you might be able to help us."
"And why would I do that?" he says. "Especially for young women who disrupt my class."
"You might be the only one who can," I say. He holds my eyes, as if taking me in for the first time. I motion to Bailey, who hands Professor Cookman her phone, the screen open to the photograph of her with her father. He reaches in his shirt pocket and pulls out a pair of glasses, turns his gaze to the phone.
"The man standing next to you in the photograph," he says, "is he the former student?"
She nods, but stays quiet. He tilts his head, takes in the photograph, like he is truly trying to remember. I try to help jog his memory. "If we have his correct graduation year, he took your class 26 years ago," I say. "We were hoping you might know his name."
"You know he took my class 26 years ago," he says, "and you don't know his name?"
"We know the name he goes by now, but we don't know his real name," I say. "It's a long story."
"I've got time for the short version," he says.
"He's my father," Bailey says. They're the first words out of Bailey's mouth, and they stop him. He looks up, meets Bailey's eyes.
"How did you tie him back to me?" he says.
I look to Bailey to see if she wants to answer, but she is quiet again, and she looks tired, too tired for 16. She looks up at me and motions. She motions for me to jump in. It turns out that my husband made up a lot of details about his life, I say. Except he did tell us a story about you, about the influence you had on him. He remembers you fondly. He looks back down at the photograph, and I think I see a flicker in his eyes as he stares down at Owen. When I look at Bailey, I know she thinks that she's noticed the same thing. But of course, this is what we want to see. He goes by Owen Michaels now, I say. But he used to go by a different name when he was your student.
And why did he change his name? He says.
That's what we're trying to figure out, I say.
Well, I've taught many students over the years, and I can't say I know him, he says.
If it helps, we're fairly certain it was your second year of teaching.
Maybe memory works differently for you, but in my experience, it gets harder the further away you get.
In my recent experience, it's all pretty much the same, I say. He smiles, taking me in, and maybe he sees it, what we are going through, because his tone softens.
Sorry, I can't be of more help, he says. Maybe try the registrar's office. They could possibly steer you in the right direction.
And what are we going to ask them? Bailey says. She's trying to stay controlled, but I see it. I see her anger brewing.
Excuse me, he says.
I'm just saying, what are we going to ask them? If they have a student on file who now goes by Owen Michaels but used to go by something else, she says. This person who has apparently evaporated into thin air.
Yes, well, you're not wrong. They probably wouldn't be able to help with that, he says. This really isn't my forte, though.
He hands Bailey her cell phone.
I wish you both luck, he says.
Then he puts his bag over his shoulder and starts walking toward the exit. Bailey stares down at her phone, back in her hands. She looks scared, scared and desperate. Professor Cookman moving away from her, Owen moving nowhere closer. We thought we were getting closer. We found Owen's professor. We got here. But now Owen just feels farther away, which may explain why I call out to Professor Cookman, why I refuse to just let him leave. My husband was the worst student you ever had, I say. Professor Cookman stops walking. He stops walking and turns around, facing us again.
What did you just say? He says.
He loves to tell this story about how he struggled in your class, and after killing himself studying for the midterm, you told him that you were going to keep his exam in a frame in your office as a lesson to future students. Not as a how-to on applying yourself, but more like, at least I'm not as bad as that guy is. He stays quiet. I keep talking, filling the silence.
Maybe that is something you do with a student every year. Especially since you had him so early on, and really, by then, who could have been a worst anything?
But it worked with him. He believed you. And instead of it frustrating him, it made him want to work harder, to prove himself to you. He still doesn't say anything. Bailey reaches for my arm, like that is something she does, trying to pull me back, to let him go.
He doesn't know, she says. We should go.
She is eerily calm, which is somehow worse than when I thought she was going to lose it. But Professor Cookman isn't moving, even though he is off the hook.
I did frame it, he says.
What?
Bailey says.
His exam. I did frame it.
He starts walking toward us.
It was my second year teaching, and I wasn't much older than the kids were. I was trying to prove my authority. My wife eventually made me take the exam down and throw it out. She said it was too mean for a crappy midterm to be any student's legacy. I didn't see it that way at first. She is smarter than I am. I kept that thing framed for a long time. It scared the crap out of my other students, which was really the point.
No one wanted to be that bad, I say.
Even when I told them how good he became afterward, he says.
He reaches out for Bailey's phone, Bailey handing it over, both of us watching as he tries to put something together.
What did he do? He says. Your father.
He directs his question to Bailey. I think she is going to offer an abbreviated version of what is happening at the shop and with Avett Thompson, and say that we don't know the rest of the story yet. We don't know how he fits into the fraud there, or why it led him to leaving us here alone, trying to put the pieces together. These impossible pieces. But instead, she shakes her head and tells him the worst part of what Owen has done.
He lied to me, she says.
He nods, like that is enough for him. Professor Cookman, first name Tobias, nickname Cook, award-winning mathematician, our new friend.
Come with me, he says.
Some students are better than others. Professor Cookman takes us back to his office, where he puts on a pot of coffee, and Cheryl, the graduate student manning his desk, is much more attentive than earlier. She powers on several computers on Cook's workstation as a second graduate student, Scott, starts going through Cook's filing cabinet, both of them moving as quickly as they can. While Cheryl downloads a copy of Owen's photograph onto the professor's laptop, Scott pulls out an enormous file, slamming the cabinet closed, and then walks back over to the desk.
The exams you have in here only go back to 2001. These are from 2001 to 2002.
Then why are you handing them to me? He says. What am I supposed to do with these?
Scott looks dumbstruck as Cheryl puts the laptop on Professor Cookman's desk.
Go and check the filing cabinets in the archives, he says. Then call the registrar and get me the class list from 1995. Also get 1994 and 1996, just to be thorough.
Scott and Cheryl head out of the office, tasked, and Cook turns to his laptop, Owen's photograph covering the screen.
So what kind of trouble is your father in, he says, if I may ask.
He works at the shop, Bailey says.
The shop, he says. Avett Thompson's operation?
Exactly, I say. He did most of the coding. He looks confused.
Coding? That's surprising. If your father is the same person that I taught, he was more interested in mathematical theory. He wanted to work for the university. He wanted to work in academia. Coding's not a natural extension of that, really.
That may be why he decided to do it, I almost say. It was a way to hide in a field adjacent to the field he was interested in, but far enough away that no one would look for him there.
Is he officially a suspect?
Cook asks. No, I say. Not officially. He motions toward Bailey.
I imagine you're just interested in finding your father. Either way.
She nods, and Cook turns his attention to me.
And how does the name change fit in exactly?
That's what we're trying to figure out, I say. He may have been in trouble before the shop. We don't know. We're only just learning about all the inconsistencies between what he's told us and...
what's true.
Yes, I say. Then I turn and look at Bailey to see how she's processing that. She looks back at me as if to say it's okay. Not that she is okay with what's going on exactly, but maybe that it's okay all the same that I'm trying to get to the bottom of things. Professor Cookman stares at the computer screen, not saying anything at first.
You don't remember all of them, but I do remember him,
he says, though I remember him having longer hair and being much heavier. He looks quite different.
But not entirely, I say.
No, he says, not entirely.
I take that in, trying to imagine Owen walking through the world, looking the way Professor Cookman is describing. I try to imagine Owen walking through the world as someone else. I look over at Bailey, and I can see it on her face. I can see it in her frown, how she's doing the same thing. Professor Cookman closes the laptop and leans across the desk toward us.
Look, I'm not going to pretend to imagine what this all feels like. But I will say, for whatever it's worth, in my years of teaching, I've discovered one thing above all else that makes me calm in moments like this. It's an Einstein theory originally, which is why it sounds better in German.
You may have to go with English, Bailey says.
Einstein said, so far as the theories of mathematics are about reality, they are not certain. So far as they are certain, they are not about reality.
Bailey tilts her head. Still waiting on the English there, Professor, she says.
It basically means we don't know shit about anything, he says.
Bailey laughs, softly but genuinely. And it's the first time she's laughed in days, the first time she's laughed since this all started. I'm so grateful that I almost leap over the table to hug Professor Cookman. Before I do, Scott and Cheryl walk back into the office. Here's the roster from the spring semester 1995. In 1994, you were teaching two different senior seminars, and in 96, you taught graduate students exclusively. Spring 95 was when you taught underclassmen, so that's the class the student would have been in.
Cheryl hands over the roster triumphantly. There were 73 people in the class, she says. 83 the first day, but then 10 dropped out. That is pretty common in terms of normal attrition. I'm assuming you don't need the names of the 10 who dropped.
No, he says.
That's what I figured. So I went ahead and crossed those out for you, she says, like she just discovered something smaller than the atom. And in my book, she has.
As Professor Cookman studies the list, Cheryl turns to us. There's not an Owen on the list, or even a Michaels on the list.
That's not a surprise, he says.
Cook keeps his eyes on the list, but he shakes his head.
I'm sorry I don't remember his name, he says. You think I would know, having had his work framed above my head for all that time.
It was a long time ago, I say.
Still, it'd be far more helpful if I could recall that much. But these names aren't adding up to anything for me.
Professor Cookman hands over the list, and I take it from him, gratefully and quickly, before he changes his mind. 73 names are a whole lot more manageable than a billion. This is a whole lot more manageable than having nowhere to start.
Assuming he's on there, Professor Cookman says.
Yes, assuming that. I look down at the printout. 73 names staring back at me, 50 of them men. Bailey peers over my shoulder to look too. We need to find a way to go through them as quickly as possible. But I am more hopeful than I have been that we have somewhere to start from, that we have a list of names to cull from, Owen somewhere among them. I feel certain of this.
You don't know how much we appreciate this, I say.
Thank you.
My pleasure, he says. I hope it helps.
We stand up to go, Cookman standing up as well. He is not particularly eager to get on with his day. Now that he is invested, he wants to find out more. He seems to want to know who Owen used to be, how that led him to where he is now, wherever that is. We start walking toward the office door when Cookman stops us.
I do want to say,
I'm not sure what is going on with him now, but I can tell you that back then, he was a nice kid and smart. It all starts to blend, but those early years, I remember some of them. Maybe because we try harder in the beginning, but I do remember. I remember he was a really good kid.
I turn back toward him, grateful to hear something about Owen, something that feels like the Owen I know. He smiles, offers a shrug.
It wasn't all his fault, the crappy midterm. He was just too focused on one of the women in the class. He wasn't the only one. In a class of mostly men, she stood out.
This is when my heart stops. Bailey turns back in Cookman's direction, too. I can almost feel her, forgetting to breathe. One of the few things Owen has told us about Olivia, repeatedly, one of the few things Bailey had to hold on to about her mother, is that her father had fallen in love with her in college. He said they had been seniors, that she had lived in the apartment next door. Had that been a lie, too? The smallest detail changed to avoid any trace of the actual past.
Was she, like, his girlfriend? Bailey says.
Can't speak to that. I only even remember her at all because he made the case that she was why his work was suffering, that he was in love. He made the case in a long letter, and I told him I was going to put it up, right next to his terrible exam, unless his work improved.
That's humiliating, Bailey says.
Apparently it was also effective, he says.
I look down at the list, scanning the names of the women, 13 in total. I search the list for an Olivia, but don't see one, though of course it may not be an Olivia I need to find.
I know this is asking a lot, but you don't remember her name, do you? The name of the woman, I say.
I remember she was a better student than your husband, he said.
Wasn't everyone, I say. Professor Cookman nods.
Yes, there's that too, he says.
14 months ago.
So how does it feel, being a married woman? Owen asks.
How does it feel being a married man? I say. We were sitting at Francis, an intimate restaurant in the Castro, at the farm table where our small wedding dinner had taken place. The day had started with the two of us getting married at City Hall. I wore a short white dress, Owen put on a tie and new Converse sneakers, and it was ending with the two of us, time rolling toward midnight, as we finished the champagne, shoes off, now that our handful of guests had left. Jules had been there, and a few friends of Owen's, Carl, Patty, and Bailey, of course Bailey. In a rare display of generosity toward me, she arrived at City Hall on time and stayed at the restaurant until after we cut the cake. She even gave me a smile before leaving to spend the night at her friend Rory's. I hoped that meant she was at least a little happy about the day. I knew it probably meant she was a little happy that Owen let her have champagne. Either way, I was taking the win.
It feels pretty great being a married man, Owen said, though I have no idea how we're getting home tonight.
I laughed. It's not a bad problem.
No, he said, not as far as problems go.
He reached for the champagne bottle, filled his glass, and refilled mine. Then he moved his chair away, sat down on the back of mine. I leaned back against him, breathing in.
We've come a long way from our second date when you wouldn't even let me drive you to dinner, he said.
I don't know about that, I said. I was pretty crazy about you, even then.
You had a funny way of showing it. I wasn't even sure I was going to get to see you again after that night.
Well, you did ask an awful lot of questions.
I had a lot to learn about you.
All in one night?
He shrugged. I felt like I needed to learn about the could-have-been boys, he said. Thought it was my best shot at not becoming one.
I reached back and touched his cheek, first with the outside of my palm, then with the inside. You became the opposite, I said.
I think that might be the single best thing anyone has ever said to me, he said.
It's true, I said. And it was true. Owen was the opposite. He had felt like the opposite from day one, from that first meeting in my workshop. But it was more than just a feeling now. He had proven himself to be the opposite. It wasn't just that it was easy to be with him, though it was, or that I felt deepened by him in a way I never had in a relationship before. It wasn't even that we understood each other in that elusive way that you either had with someone or you could never quite find, that pervasive shorthand in which a look could tell us what the other person needed, time to leave the party, time to reach for me, time to give me room to breathe. It was a little bit of all of that, and something far bigger than all of that. How do you explain it when you find in someone what you've been waiting for your whole life? Do you call it fate? It feels lazy to call it fate. It's more like finding your way home, where home is a place you secretly hoped for, a place you imagined, but where you'd never before been. Home. When you weren't sure you'd ever get to have one. That's what he was to me. That's who he was. Owen pulled my palm to his lips, held me there.
So, are you going to answer my question about how it feels, he said, to be a married woman?
I shrugged. Not sure yet, I said. Too soon to tell. He laughed.
Okay, well, that's all right, he said.
I took a sip of my champagne. I took a sip and laughed, too. I couldn't help it. I was happy. I was just happy.
Turns out you have a little while to decide, he said.
Like the rest of our lives, I said.
I hope longer than that, he said.
If you marry the prom king. 73 names, 50 of them men. One of them is potentially Owen. We walk quickly across campus toward the main research library, which Cheryl tells us is most likely to house the school yearbooks. If we can get our hands on the yearbooks from the years Owen was at UT, that could be the key to getting through this list as quickly as possible. The yearbooks will offer not just student names, but they'll offer photographs, too. They'll potentially have a photograph of a young Owen, if he did anything at school besides fail math. We head inside the Perry Castaneda Library, which is enormous. 6 stories of books and maps and cards and computer labs. And head to the research librarian's desk. She informs us that we will need to put a request in at the archives to get the hard copies of the school yearbooks from that far back, but we can access the archive on a library computer. We go to the second floor computer lab, which is mostly empty, and sit at 2 computers in the corner. I pull up Owen's freshman and sophomore yearbooks on one computer, and Bailey pulls up his junior and senior years. And side by side, we begin looking up students from Cookman's class, one at a time, hitting the roster alphabetically. Our first candidate, John Abbott from Baltimore, Maryland. I find him in one grainy photograph with the ski club. He doesn't look much like Owen in the photograph. Thick glasses, full beard. But it is hard to rule him out completely, just based on that one photograph. We find too many potential hits when we Google just his name, but when I cross-reference with skiing, I find that John Abbott, Baltimore native, UT Austin grad, now lives in Aspen with his partner and their 2 kids.
We are able to rule out the next few male students on the list much more easily. One is 5 feet tall and has curly red hair. Another is 6'4" and a professional ballet dancer who resides in Paris. One is living in Honolulu, Hawaii, and running for state senate. We are on the ease when my phone rings. Home comes up on the caller ID. For a second, I imagine that it's Owen. Owen is back at the house and calling to tell us that he has worked everything out and we need to come home immediately, so he can explain the parts that don't make sense, where he has been, who he was before I knew him, why he has left these things out. But it isn't Owen on the phone. It's Jules. Jules is responding to the text I'd sent her at the hotel bar, asking her to head to the house, asking her to find the piggy bank. "I'm in Bailey's room," she says when I pick up. "Was anyone outside?" I say. "I don't think so. I didn't see anyone strange in the parking lot, and there wasn't anyone on the docks." "Would you close the blinds while you're there?" "Already done," she said. I look over at Bailey, hoping she's too busy with the yearbooks to pay close attention, but I clock her eyeing me, waiting to see what this phone call is about. Maybe, hoping against hope, this is going to be the call that gets her back to her father. "And you were right," Jules says. "It does say Lady Paul on the side." She doesn't say what it is, of course. She doesn't say it's a piggy bank that she is at our house to retrieve, Bailey's piggy bank, though it would sound pretty innocuous if she did say that out loud. I hadn't imagined it. The small note on the bottom of the last page of Owen's will, listing the conservator, L. Paul. It was also the name on the side of the blue piggy bank in Bailey's room, Lady Paul, written in black beneath the bow. The same blue piggy bank Owen had taken when we evacuated, the one I found him with at the hotel bar in the middle of the night. I chalked it up to his being sentimental, but I was wrong. He had taken the piggy bank because it was something he needed to keep safe. "But there is a bit of an issue," Jules says. "I can't open it." "What do you mean you can't open it?" I say. "Just smash it with a hammer." "No, you don't understand. There's a safe inside the piggy bank," she says. "And the thing's made of steel. I'm going to have to find someone who can crack a safe. Any ideas?" "Not off the top of my head," I say. "Okay, I'll deal with it," Jules says. "But have you checked your news feed? They indicted Jordan Maverick." Jordan is the COO of the shop, Avitt's number two, and Owen's counterpart on the business side of the firm. He was newly divorced and had been spending a little bit of time at our place. I invited Jules over for dinner, hoping they'd hit it off. They didn't. She thought he was boring. I thought there were worse things to be. Or maybe I just didn't see him that way. "For the record," she says, "no more setups." "Understood," I say. At a different moment, this would have been all the encouragement I needed to ask her about her colleague, Max, to make a joke about whether he was the other reason she wasn't interested in setups. But in this moment, all it does is remind me that Max has an inside source, one that can potentially help us in regard to Owen. "Has Max heard anything beyond Jordan?" I ask. "Has he heard anything about Owen?" Bailey tilts her head toward me. "Not specifically," she says, "but his source over at the FBI did say the software just became functional." "What does that mean?" I ask. Except I can guess what that means. It means Owen probably thought he was out of the woods. He probably thought any contingency plan he needed to create could be put on the back burner again. It means that when Jules called Owen and said they were coming in, he couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that this close to being safe, he was about to be caught. "Max is texting me," Jules says. "I'll call you after I find a safe cracker, okay?" "I bet those are some words you thought you'd never say," she laughs. "No kidding,"
I say goodbye and turn to Bailey. That was Jules, I say. I'm having her look into something at the house. She nods. She doesn't ask if I have anything to report on her father. She knows I'd tell her if I did. Any progress? I say. I'm on H, she says. No hits yet.
H is progress.
Yeah, unless he's not on the list.
My phone rings again. I think it's going to be Jules calling back, but the number is one I don't recognize, one with a 512 area code. Texas.
Who's that? She says.
I shake my head that I don't know. Then I accept the call. The woman on the other end of the line is already talking to me. She is midway through a sentence that, apparently, she thought I was there to hear.
Scrimmages, she says. We should have accounted for them, too. The scrimmages.
Who's this?
It's Eleanor McGovern, she says, from the Episcopal Church. And I think I may have found an answer for you about the wedding your stepdaughter attended. Sophie, one of our longtime parishioners, has a son who plays football for UT Austin. She never misses a game. She was in here earlier, helping with the new member breakfast, and it occurred to me she might be the person to ask if I'd missed something. And she said that during the summer, the Longhorns have a series of intra-squad scrimmages.
My breath catches in my throat. And they're held in the stadium? I say. Just like the regular season games?
Just like the regular season games. Usually with a fairly packed crowd. People go as if it's an actual game, she says. I'm not much of a football fan, so that didn't occur to me at first.
It occurred to you to ask her. That's pretty great, I say.
Well, maybe. And this part certainly is. I did a cross-check for you on the dates of the scrimmages during the time we were open. We had one wedding that lines up with the final scrimmage of the 2008 season. One wedding that your stepdaughter might have been at.
Do you have a pen? You should write this down. Eleanor is proud of herself, and she should be. She may have found a link to Owen, to what Owen had been doing in Austin that weekend, so long after graduation. And to why Bailey was with him.
I'm writing it down, I say. It was the Reyes and Smith wedding, she says. I have all the information on the wedding here. The ceremony took place at noon, and the reception was held off-site. It doesn't specify where.
Eleanor, this is amazing. I don't even know how to thank you for this.
You're so welcome, she says.
I reach across Bailey to pick up the printout of Cookman's class. There it is. No Reyes, but one Smith. Catherine. Catherine Smith. I point to her name, and Bailey starts typing quickly, searching for the yearbook index. Catherine Smith coming up. Smith, Catherine. 10 page numbers by her name. Maybe they were friends. Or she had been Owen's girlfriend, the one that Professor Cookman remembered. And Owen had been in town for Catherine's wedding. He had brought his family back to help his old friend celebrate. Maybe if I could find her, she could shed light on who Owen used to be.
Was her first name Catherine, Eleanor?
No, not Catherine. Let me see. Bride's first name is Andrea, Eleanor says. And, yes, there we are. Andrea Reyes and Charlie Smith.
I feel deflated that it wasn't Catherine herself, but maybe she is related to Charlie somehow. This could certainly still be the connection. But before I can repeat that to Bailey, she turns to a page featuring the Debate Society and President Catherine Kate Smith. And the photograph comes up. It's a group photograph of the entire debate team. They are sitting on bar stools in a small, old-school bar, more like a cocktail lounge than a traditional pub. Wooden rafters, a long brick wall, bourbon bottles lined up like presents. Lanterns line the bar top, backlighting those bottles, backlighting the dark wine bottles above them. The caption under the photograph reads, "Debate Team President Catherine Smith celebrates winning the state championship at her family's bar, the Never Dry, with teammates from left to right."
"No way," Bailey says. "That could be the bar, where the wedding was."
"What are you talking about?"
"I didn't say anything, but last night when we were at Magnolia Cafe and you were asking me all those questions, I remembered being at a bar for the wedding," she says. "Or more like some sort of small restaurant. But then I figured it was late and I was just grasping for something, anything, so I let it go. I didn't even mention it. But this place in the photo, this Never Dry bar, looks like the bar."
I cover the phone's mouthpiece and look down at Bailey, who is pointing with fever, almost in disbelief. She points to a record player in the corner, a weird kind of proof.
"I'm not kidding," she says. "That's the bar. I recognize it."
"There are a million bars that look like that."
"I know. But there are two things I remember about Austin," she said, "and that bar is one of them."
Which is when Bailey makes the photograph bigger. The debate team faces growing less blurry, Catherine's face becoming delineated, easy to see. We both go silent. The bar doesn't matter anymore. Owen doesn't even matter exactly. All that matters is the face. It isn't a photograph matching the woman I know as Bailey's mother. That, more important, Bailey knows to be her mother. Olivia. Olivia of the red hair and girlish freckles. Olivia who looks a little like me. But the woman staring back at us, this woman, Catherine Kate Smith, looks like Bailey. Exactly like Bailey. She has the same dark hair. She has the same full cheeks, and most notably, she has the same fierce eyes, judgmental more than sweet. This woman staring back at us, she could be Bailey. Bailey shuts off the screen suddenly, as if it is too much to look at. The photograph, Kate's face matching her own. She looks over at me, wondering what I am going to do next.
"Do you know her?" she says.
"No," I say. "Do you?"
"No, I don't know," she says. "No."
"Hello," Eleanor says. "Are you still there?" I keep my hand over the speaker, but Bailey can hear her through the phone. She can hear her loud-pitched questions. It's making her even more tense than she is. Her shoulders are seizing. Her hands are reaching for her hair, pulling it tight behind her ears. I'm not proud of this, but I hang up on Eleanor. Then I turn back to Bailey.
"We need to go there right now," Bailey says. "I need to go to this bar, to this Never Dry."
She is already standing up. She is already grabbing her things. "Bailey," I say. "I know you're upset. I know you are. I'm upset too." We aren't saying it yet, not out loud, who we think Catherine Smith may be, who Bailey fears and hopes she is. "Let's just talk this through for a second," I say. "I think our best chance to get to the bottom of all this is to keep going through the class roster. We are at most 46 men away from getting an answer to who your father used to be."
"Maybe we are. Maybe we're not."
"Bailey," I say. She shakes her head. She doesn't sit back down.
"Let me say this another way," she says. "I'm going to the bar right now. You can come with me or you can let me go alone."
She stands there and waits. She doesn't storm out. She waits to see what I will do, as if there is a choice. "I go with you, of course," I say. Then I stand up, and we walk together toward the door.